Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
It is Monday, February 14th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Let me start by wishing you all a happy Valentine's Day. And as our gift to you today, do we have chocolates? No. Do we have flowers? No. Do we have a wonderful greeting card set up by the nefarious greeting card industry, which has made this entire fictional holiday something so they could sell their trite little hackneyed phrases? No. We do have for you a wonderful show. I don't know if this is going to be the best show that we've ever had. I don't know for sure. I think it's going to be in the top five. Today on the program, we will welcome Washington White House correspondent Dan Frumkin of the Huffington Post will be joining us. Also on this program, I just got off the Skype machine and recorded an interview with Glenn Greenwald on this entire WikiLeaks Chamber of Commerce. Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise.
The forces that, the corporate forces that fear WikiLeaks use the same nefarious outfits that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce uses when they want to spy, extort, when they want to defame and target individuals and institutions that are fighting for freedom, for fighting anti-corporate forces. Not a, a terrible shock. And so we will have all those. It's going to be, there's going to be a lot less of me today, at least in terms of telling you stories, because we've got these two interviews. We're going to do them almost back to back. And then, of course, we will go into our post show, which I must warn you, surprisingly, things have gone well on our end in creating a system where we will sequester the post show show. We will be sending out emails on approximately Wednesday to members, giving them their special information they will need to receive the entire 90-minute show. That includes the show and the post show, or if you want, the pre-show and the show. It depends on your perspective. So to avoid missing. Now, if this was a normal day, I think what I would probably do, if this was a day like next week, one of these interviews would probably be in the post show. I don't know. I can't say for sure because they're both big, big interviews. But tomorrow we're going to have Marin on, and he'll be in the post show. Now, you will still have access to the post show because in our benevolence here at the Majority Report, we've decided to give you until Wednesday or Thursday to join and become a member. Again, if you're a hardship case, if you're having a tough time of it, send me an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We'll work something out. And to support the show, you can always go to Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. Buy some coffee, buy some tea, buy some chocolate. I had friends over this weekend. Sold them. I didn't actually sell them, but I sold them on Just Coffee. They loved it. And I told them, put Majority in the coupon code, get 10% off, and I'll see some coin. You can also donate your Twitter account at donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. You can allow us one tweet a month, one tweet a week, or one tweet a day. Like, for instance, today we tweeted out about this show with our two guests because it's such a great show. And if you buy Amazon products through our link at the majority.fm bookstore/DVD store, you can either buy books there or DVDs, or just click through the link at the top and you can just shop like you normally do. Bookmark that link. Buy whatever you buy from Amazon. We will see a slight commission from that. As always, send guest suggestions and check me out on Ring of Fire Radio this weekend. On Saturdays, you can stream it live at ringoffireradio.com. Find out more information for your local listings. It's on in 50 cities across the country. Mike Papantonio, Bobby Kennedy Jr., myself, I've joined that show. You should listen and maybe become a podcaster. All right, we have just a couple minutes here. I want to go and give you an update on what's happening with Egypt. As you know, Hosni Mubarak, do we know where he is at this point?
No, I don't think so.
He's in a bunker somewhere near Sharm el Sheikh, or maybe he's in the United Emirates, or in Dubai. I don't know if anyone's quite sure. There are reports of all of these places. Desperately figuring out how to lug around a suitcase full of money. Not so easy for a dictator these days on the run. It's not like the old days where you could just, I was a dictator for a while, now I'll move to Beverly Hills. Now, these ingrates, his subjects, are like, hey, well, where's all that money you took from us? And meanwhile, thousands of Egyptian state employees, from ambulance drivers to policemen and transport workers, protested Monday in Cairo. This according to the AP and Huffington Post, in a wave of labor unrest unleashed by the uprising that ousted President Hosni Mubarak. This actually was starting in the last days of the protests. Sometime around Wednesday of last week, there were reports of massive labor strikes across the country. Outside the Nileside TV and state radio building, hundreds of public transport workers demonstrated to demand better pay. Several hundred protesters from the state youth and sports organization also protested Monday in Tahrir or Liberation Square with similar demands. In the Giza district, hundreds of ambulance drivers protested, also looking for better pay and job security. Apparently, there was about 70 ambulances parked alongside the river. In Cairo, 200 policemen demonstrated, saying we were also victims of this regime. They want better pay. Banks remain closed across the country. There was a massive strike by the employees of the National Bank. And as you know, the ruling military council, the Supreme, I don't know, it's some majestic name, the Supreme Military Council.
I think that's it, yeah.
When they took power on Friday from Mubarak, they are trying basically to crack down. Called on Egyptians to return to work. They said no labor protests. They meanwhile have dissolved a parliament. They suspended the constitution. They are promising elections. They met on Sunday with representatives of the youth movement. That would include some of those Facebookers, some of El Baradei's youth. I would imagine some Muslim Brotherhood youth. Wael Ghonim, the Google executive, who we've discussed many times, said that meetings between this military council and youth representative, he said, was encouraging. He just said on Twitter just moments ago, breaking the psychological barrier of fear is the tipping point of any revolution in any police-driven regime led by a dictator. And the military apparently is encouraging these youth parties to form full-on political parties. So it remains to be seen. Professor Juan Cole gave a talk at Columbia this weekend. He put the Bayesian, and that is sort of, what is the definition of Bayesian? I mean, I know it's sort of like some type of odds. It's basically odds maker, but there's probably a specific reference there that I am not aware of. Chances of legitimate democracy growing in Egypt, 20%, but who knows? You know, I think the combination of labor and what we would call in this country the creative class. Those youthful internet types. Quite powerful. I was on Virtually Speaking last night with Jay Aykroyd, Second Life, and we will post on the roundup today a link to that podcast. If you go back in my tweet, you can find the link to that page, and it has the podcast there. I think it should be up by now. And, you know, one of the things that I talk about is something I've been sort of discussing and coming to on my own over the past week on this program. It's just sort of the confluence of this revolution, not exclusively resting on this Facebook, but, you know, from a tactical standpoint and from a, you know, revolutions tend to happen when you have both labor and poor people and then also the upper middle class, the intelligentsia, the creative class, whatever you want to call those people, manage to get on the same page. And these Facebook youth certainly from a tactical standpoint, the internet was crucial to them. And perhaps in, you know, getting a guy who's living in the UAE to be such a central focus of this revolution, it's fascinating. And then you look and see how Anonymous struck back at this cybersecurity firm, which had been hired from a prominent law firm, and Glenn Greenwald goes into great detail of this relationship, but how they have now released 71,000 emails from the security firm, which has done work via a top law firm in Washington for the greatest corporate interest in this country. And you see things like WikiLeaks becoming such a central repository for information that people referred to Suleiman as the torturer in this country on mass media without even having to cite the fact that it actually came from a WikiLeaks cable. That our knowledge that Suleiman was the receiver of extraordinarily rendered people was, if not first reported, but at least reinforced through these WikiLeaks cables. There's definitely something that's happening that, in many ways, you know, I'm just a little bit old. So I talked to Kyle, who is our chief tech guru here. Not just our, he's not our chief tech guru. He is a chief tech guru who lends us his services. And it's just a fascinating world. And I think it's going to become more and more relevant. In the meantime, we need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Dan Frumkin. He is the senior Washington correspondent for the Huffington Post. And we're going to talk about the budget proposals. We are entering an age of austerity, folks. And we do not have allies in the White House to fight off this austerity. And certainly the right wing in this country, very excited to send us all into a spiraling era of austerity, joblessness. It doesn't look pretty. But let's talk to Dan Frumkin about it. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Chief Washington correspondent from the Huffington Post, Dan Frubkin. Welcome to the program, Dan.
Thank you, Sam. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. We are just going to pull up, pod you up a little bit. Okay. And today or over the weekend, we saw a dueling release of budgets, which I would describe as bad and worse. one coming from the White House, one coming from the Republicans, all of which seems to buy into the central premise that the government is just like a family, and we need to tighten our belts, and that somehow the economy is going to miraculously rebound if we put less money into it.
Yeah, it's amazing. I was reading the note, which has gone from the font of conventional wisdom in this town to sort of not very relevant, but nevertheless, this morning it was pointing out that the big challenge for both the Democrats and Republicans was to demonstrate to the public how their versions of budget cuts were going to actually stimulate job growth. And I was like, yeah, that's a big challenge because it's impossible. Because, both of these budgets go in the absolute wrong direction as far as what the country needs right now. So I would say, yes, underwhelming and insane rather than bad and worse.
Now, let's start with what is not in the White House budget. And, we saw the Wall Street Journal reported just the other day, and this is something that people had been talking about quite a bit, but that the White House specifically made a decision sometime in the past couple of weeks, probably prior to the State of the Union address, while they were weighing it seriously, they ultimately decided not to push for any, at least at this point, any cuts in Social Security benefits by way of raising the retirement age, by way of rejiggering the cost of living increases, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one sort of big solace for progressives, but we've known that for a while now. I mean, there was a lot of worry during the fall and the summer that the Obama administration was really going to take embrace the decisions of their deficit commission, but it became pretty clear just before the State of the Union, like you said, that this would have been just a really disastrous move for his for the party and for his own election prospects, I think. So yeah, so they don't mention that. They say they're devoted to not slashing Social Security, but which is as far as that goes, it's like I guess that's pretty good.
Right, and some of the things, one of the big things that Obama announced was halving the low income heating assistance to 2008 levels.
Yeah, that came as a huge shock. I mean, if you're sitting around trying to find, things to cut that you can then, say, tell people, look how responsible we are, you'd think they would have picked something a little bit less dramatic than that. I mean, the image of elderly people freezing to death in these cold winters is just, it really seems like bad PR. And I don't get, I've been looking, I can't find sort of the rationale for why they picked this program in particular. Yes, it did go up a lot, from one year to the next, but then cutting it back down, it just seems brutal. I mean, and it opens you up to a whole host of really unfortunate metaphors, right?
Do you have a sense as to why, from politically, they thought this was going to be helpful? Is the bottom line, it's just easier and more expedient to really impose deep cuts on poor people because they just have less political clout?
It's hard to argue against that position. I don't think anybody, adopts that position sort of consciously, but I think the way things work in this town a lot of the time is that you do what you're going to get, the thing that will get you in the least amount of trouble. And I think the perception accurately here is that, there's a lot of very, very, powerful interests defending the interests of the powerful and the rich. And not so on the poor. But I mean, the irony here of, Barack Obama, community organizer, actually cutting, community service block grants, it's just incredible. No one could have ever predicted this.
I mean, what's the theory here? Is it? I mean, what is the political theory? I mean, yeah. we'll get into the Republican cutting things, but you know, you had a piece about Austin Goolsbee, Obama's or one of his top economic advisors, basically, and sort of perfectly enough, at the Aspen Institute roundtable, saying that you know, Republicans need to be responsible in this budget. Now, I mean, this is obviously, I mean, it's childish on some level to say this, but this is obviously some type of theater. They think they're appealing to somebody, some mythical independent voter who wants to see that still the Obama administration is willing to placate the right wing. But then they go out and then they provide these type of budget cuts. Do they think they're going to politically, I guess, benefit from being Republican light by buying into this frame of it helps the economy to cut
spending? It's incredibly hard to come up with any actual sort of economic philosophy that would support this kind of a budget. So I think it has to be it is a political document. So what do they think the political, you know, what are their political goals? What do they think this will achieve? I think it's what you were alluding to back then, that before, that they sort of want to be able to take the position, we are putting forth a grown-up, mature, you know, reasonable budget, like, you know, we're responsible grown-ups, and then they're going to basically be able to portray the Republicans as a bunch of children having a tantrum. That's their hope politically. And I do think that, you know, the one thing you can say about the Obama administration is the only time it looks really good is when you compare it to the Republicans. You know, the only time Obama looks like a great president is when you think about George W. Bush. So, you know, so I think that this is all about sort of outflanking the Republicans and setting up this narrative where they're the responsible ones and you can't possibly elect these crazy people in 2012. That said, you know, you've come up with a budget that is kind of hard to understand on any other terms, and is hard, certainly hard for people to get excited about, because it's so depressing, and it also misses what I, you know, it misses what I think is the more important political issue in America, which is jobs. There's no way you can look at this and say this is a stimulus budget. This is what this country needs to start creating jobs again.
And so what is the calculation here, that jobs are going to come back on their own, and or that simply the American public is perfectly willing to accept 9.5, whatever that figure is, percent unemployment in 2012?
Well, Sam, I mean, the fact of the matter is that they're right about one thing. They really couldn't get anything passed through the House right now that is a stimulus. It does do job creation. I mean, one of the things I was doing for a while was trying to figure out what job creation measures could the president do essentially unilaterally without the House. And I came up with a whole lot of things that the president can do unilaterally, but none of them that really create a whole lot of jobs. Mm-hmm. So he's really, you know, I mean, this is in a way the chickens coming home to roost from the first 2 years when he didn't take a Democratic Congress and demand a second stimulus bill or first one that was larger or more job creation measures. There were, you know, two dozen job creation measures he could have adopted, you know, back when he had a Democratic Congress if he pushed really hard. But, So instead, he's in this position now where he really can't win. There's nothing much he can do to address the jobs issue. So he tries to address this whole political framing issue, I guess.
Dan, let me ask you this: do you think that when we hear this type of stuff from you know, that we see this, is this really a function of Obama being of simply missing the boat, or do you think that this is a function of do you think this was a function of this is his political ideology? I mean, you know, we speak in these terms as if he, you know, this was poor negotiation skills or poor tactical mm-hmm. skills or mm-hmm. but isn't at one point the likely explanation is that he really believes this stuff?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, you know, some people who had been following Obama very closely, including some who'd even worked for him, sort of warned us, you know, before the election. This is not the guy you think he is. He's not very ideological. He's a sort of a bureaucrat, and I think that's what happened. I mean, you can spend a lot of time trying to find someone else to blame for this stuff, but ultimately he's making the calls. I mean, everybody, there's no question he's a very smart guy, so I don't think he's being, hoodwinked by anybody. I think he's not interested in these negotiating games. And, frankly, that's what I would have hoped Rahm would have brought, but he didn't, for one reason or the other, that sort of hardball negotiating tactics. So, I think this is pretty much what he wants. Now, the problem is it's all going to blow up in his face now because, I don't see the Republicans going along with any of this stuff. He's really hoping that they'll say, hey, this is actually a pretty decent Republican budget. Let's embrace it. But they have no interest in that whatsoever. They're also not actually looking at anything from ideological ground. They're just doing a sort of a slash and burn. They want to do anything that hurts him right now. So it's hard to say what he's up to.
Let's go over some of these Republican cuts. And people are still parsing this budget, but the WIC, a nutritional program for pregnant women and women with young children. They're cutting. What I mean is it? Gosh, almost 100 million. Is it more from the WIC?
The proportions are incredible.
Food for Peace, $544 million from the EPA, and clean water and drinking water, about $1.8 billion. They're cutting Pell Grants by 15%. Mm-hmm. They're cutting Head Start funding. They're cutting meat and food inspection by $100 million.
Yeah.
What is America going to look like, if we get some combination of the Republican and Democratic budget?
Well, that's the question. I just don't see how this works out. I don't see how either side can, at this point, accept a compromise. So I don't see how they can have any agreement whatsoever. So, I think the most likely scenario is some sort of very awkward continuing resolution, perhaps for the rest of the Obama presidency. But to answer your underlying question, if we made cuts like this, we would be probably heading into a double dip recession, which is something not a lot of people want to talk about. But, it happened in 1937.
So wait a second. Are you saying that it's very possible that what we might do is just actually like have a series of continuing resolutions, which would essentially keep the budget where it's at now,
or with slight increases? I don't know. That's what I'm going to actually try to spend some time this afternoon talking to my budget gurus about that. But they didn't pass a budget last year. That was with the Democratic Congress.
So, honestly,
Sam, why would you think they'd pass one this year?
Is there a precedent for this type of situation going on for, multiple years?
I see you are asking these really good questions that I'm trying to get answers to right now. And I don't know. I don't think there's a precedent for going on for years, no.
And so from a political standpoint, what would the outcome of that be? What if there was a series of every 4 months a vote to have a continuing resolution because there couldn't be a budget? I mean, would the Republicans be afraid of shutting down the government? Is that basically it?
Certainly, the mainstream Republicans, to whatever extent you can say that, I don't think want to shut down the government. I think they want to take a stand. So the point is, the continuing resolution would be a way of preventing the shutdown of the government. The Tea Partiers certainly do want to shut down the government. I mean, they're just absolutely eager for a fight here, and whether it's on the budget or whether it's on the debt limit, they're dying to sort of go down in flames. But no, I don't know. I'm not sure. I want to talk to some of these guys who really understand the budget process and give me a sense of what they think is likely to happen.
And from a political standpoint, it would almost be almost like a policy standpoint, a stalemate of the type that you're talking about, where it would be continuing resolution, would probably be the best case scenario for progressives who want to avoid these type of budget cuts.
who don't want to see some of this stuff really badly cut, yeah.
Huh, very interesting. Well, Dan Frumkin, we will keep an eye on Huffington Post to see what you find from these budget experts.
Yeah, we're actually doing a live blog on the budget, so in case, you know, people don't think we're wonky enough, we're certainly wonking out today, so check that out.
All right, people, head over to Huffington Post, check out Dan Frumkin. We've got to take a break, folks. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Sam, a pleasure.
When we come back, we will be talking, we will be playing the interview that I did with Glenn Greenwald just about an hour ago, and so stick around. We'll be right back. All right, folks, now we're going to play this interview with Glenn Greenwald. It is a 30-minute-long interview, after which I will take your IMs at majority.fm. I will come back. Glenn Greenwald, of course, the author of, I think I say all this in the interview. So let's go to it now. Remember, he's on Skype from far, far away. And interesting, I think you're going to enjoy this. Okay, now I'd like to welcome to the show Glenn Greenwald. Of course, he writes at Salon.com. He's the author of at least two New York Times bestsellers that come to mind. And he is, actually, in some respects, part of this story. It's a fascinating story that centers around a, essentially, started with Anonymous, this group that is part of the hacktivist community, going and taking, essentially releasing now 77,000 emails from a private security company. Glenn, take us through this story. There seems to be multiple elements that have come out of this huge email release.
Right. Well, the story essentially is pretty simple in terms of what actually happened, which is that the CEO of this security firm, H.P. Gary, whose name is Aaron Barr, basically conducted an investigation into this group called Anonymous, which is basically a worldwide group of hackers who gained notoriety because they announced that they were going to retaliate against anyone who unfairly targeted WikiLeaks. So about 2 months ago, they launched a bunch of cyber attacks on companies that had terminated their services with WikiLeaks, such as Amazon and MasterCard and PayPal, and Visa. You know, basic denial of service attacks that just slow down those sites for a day or so. And so this H.P. Gary, which touts itself as an internet security firm, they do work for the government, started boasting that they had investigated Anonymous, had infiltrated them, and had uncovered the identities of numerous leading hackers who are part of this group.
Now we will for the time being not talk about just the sort of the arrogance that this guy showed in his process of tracking them down. But it turns out he was wrong, and Anonymous basically struck back, and I'm the paraphrasing them, you have stuck your finger in the beehive, and now you're about to get stung.
Right, and get stung he definitely did. What they basically did was they tricked, I think, somebody at the company into providing them with the passwords to the email system, and they were able to hack into the email account for which he, this Aaron Barr, it was the administrator, and download 50,000 or more now, 75,000 emails on H.P. Gary's server. They also hacked into his Twitter account and sent out all kinds of embarrassing and vulgar messages, having annexed that account as well as other online accounts as well. And among the 70,000 emails that they were able to obtain, and they just randomly obtained them, they weren't searching for anything in particular, they didn't know there was anything specifically incriminating, but among these emails were at least two proposals designed to, on behalf of prospective clients, basically discredit and attack and destroy people who were taking certain political positions that the prospective client disliked. In one case, they wanted to propose to Bank of America targeting WikiLeaks and various supporters, including me, with all kinds of nefarious and potentially illegal schemes to discredit and attack and threaten those supporters out of advocating for WikiLeaks. And in another case, on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce, they wanted to do the same to progressive groups and activists who are critical of the Chamber of Commerce. And that's what has kind of produced a lot of controversy, is that the firms that were involved in these discussions, not just H.P. Gary, but also Palantir Technologies, Barraco Technologies, and most of all, Hunton and Williams, the very large and well-connected D.C. law firm, that represents both the Chamber of Commerce and Bank of America. These are very serious and legitimate players. And so to see all of them discussing in email these kind of odious schemes to basically destroy the credibility of political adversaries is why this has become a news story.
And we'll get into the separate cases here in a moment. But one thing that is apparent, that when the Chamber of Commerce basically hired this law firm, and the law firm in turn began to solicit proposals from H.B. Gary and these two other entities, Palantir and the
Barraco.
In both instances, these are separate incidences brought together only by the fact that all of the evidence of it happened to come in this one email leak. In both instances, all three of these organizations were, if not contracted, at least solicited for ideas as a team. In fact, in the Chamber of Commerce situation, they're known as Team Themis. And I don't know if that's the same in the on the WikiLeaks end of it from Bank of America, but this is clearly an ongoing relationship.
It's an ongoing relationship, and beyond those three firms, this is all being coordinated by and solicited from Hunton and Williams, and specifically a partner there, John Woods. And Hunton and Williams is a serious player in Washington lobbying and legal circles. And one of the emails specifically indicates that Hunton and Williams became in contact with Bank of America because an official at the Justice Department, talking to Bank of America about what they should do about WikiLeaks, recommended Hunton and Williams. So it was the DOJ that put Hunton and Williams in touch with Bank of America to do this kind of work. And of course, the Justice Department is obsessed with harming and otherwise and prosecuting and otherwise impeding what WikiLeaks is doing. And this is really, Sam, for me, the most significant aspect of this story, which is it would be one thing if some conscientious whistleblower within one of these organizations decided that this was just a bridge too far, that this was patently illegal or improper, and therefore disclosed it because they learned about it and wanted the public to know what was going on. But that isn't what happened. What happened is these were just 40,000 random emails grabbed by anonymous and then published on the internet. And it just so happened that these randomly selected emails contained at least two different, very incriminating and disturbing plans, participated in, at least at the discussion level, by very serious and well-connected security firms and law firms on behalf of some of the most well-funded clients in the country. I mean, of course, Chamber of Commerce is, one of the biggest political players in the country, and Bank of America is the single largest bank. So, what this to me shows is just how common this is, that basically if you just randomly grabbed 40,000 emails from any of security firms or large corporations or their lawyers and investigators, I think you'd likely find not necessarily identical, but similarly pernicious proposals. This is what happens in that world.
And I would add that as of, I guess it was this morning, according to Threat Post, I guess it was last night at 9:30 p.m., another 27,000 emails are out there. So it brings the total to close to 70,000 emails. And I got to imagine that these have not all been sifted through. There is, it would strain the boundaries of the law of averages that there aren't another bunch of stories like this at this point in those emails.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, Anonymous is not actually the ones who discovered the incriminating stories here. They were the ones who simply hacked into the email system and then posted it. It was left to others to go through it. And one person in particular found one of these incriminating emails, kind of followed the chain, and then alerted this website that writes about technology issues called the Tech Herald to it, and they then wrote the story. So I know, you know, these emails as well, they were in a format that was very difficult to read. And I know, for example, FireDog Lake employed at least 10 people over the last many days to put these emails into some kind of where they could actually be gone through and looked at and read. And it took them a long time to do, and they're not even done yet. So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I doubt very seriously that anybody has read through anywhere close to all of the emails. So it's very possible that even more incriminating matter is lurking and just hasn't yet been discovered, especially in that new batch.
Now, we don't know if any of these proposals were undertaken. And now the players involved have the two security firms have distanced themselves from H.B. Gary. No one is denying outright that these emails are legitimate. H.B. Gary has tried to imply that they may be falsified. Of course, I don't know how you falsify 70,000 emails.
I don't think. You're right. They what they said was that because these were purloined or improperly obtained, that it's possible that that they may not be authentic. But they didn't say at all that these emails were. Remember, it's now been a week since this story has erupted, and not one of the players involved has remotely insinuated that these emails are anything but authentic. And in fact, Palantir Technologies, which is a very large firm out in Palo Alto that relies a lot on, you know, the Palo Alto community, which tends to be civil libertarians and progressives about internet freedom and very supportive of WikiLeaks. They're quite petrified of the impact that this is going to have on their image as well as being sued. And the company contacted me and, you know, apologized profusely. The CEO has called me and has done the same. And they've emailed me several subsequent follow-ups. In which they are acknowledging that these emails are authentic. So there's no question at this point about their authenticity.
Is there anything that's been found in these emails? Like I said, all we have seen so far is our proposals that have been solicited. There's at no time, let me ask you this, from what has been found, are you aware of any emails that suggest that anyone involved in this at all said, hey, this is, you're going too far, you shouldn't do this type of stuff?
That definitely did not happen. There is no email of any kind that I'm aware of or that anybody has pointed to in which anybody said this is excessive or this is improper. There are emails responding to these proposals that suggest that everybody involved was satisfied with what had been proposed.
Are there, and one would also imagine that if these emails existed, if one of the players, whether it was at the law firm or whether it was one of the other security operations or whether it was at the Chamber or at Bank of America, I would imagine if someone said, oh, I remember sending an email saying this is wrong, they would have released it by now.
Well, right. I mean, remember, Bank of America and the Chamber of Commerce are very vigorously denying involvement in these proposals. And not only are they denying involvement, but they've denounced them quite emphatically. Bank of America described it as abhorrent and said, we have no interest in anything like this. The Chamber of Commerce said something quite similar. So, you know, I don't think that they would have issued, those entities would have issued denials quite that emphatic if they had actually retained these firms to carry out their proposals. I think, though, that what has happened is that it was Hunton and Williams, their law firms, that were essentially coordinating the efforts on their behalf. So it wouldn't have been Bank of America or the Chamber of Commerce that would have directly retained H.B. Gary or Palantir or Barrico. It would have been Hunton and Williams retaining one of those firms as the coordinating firm to do it, and Hunton and Williams has thus far refused to comment. Palantir says, that to their knowledge, that there was no effort to retain H.B. Gary to carry out the WikiLeaks part of the plan. They haven't said anything to me about the Chamber of Commerce part. But even there, they're saying that the denial is very carefully worded and very, very narrow. They're saying that the H.B. Gary specific proposal that people have read was never retained by Bank of America, but whether Hunt and Williams retained this consortium to do something similar, either in regards to the WikiLeaks case or the Bank of America case, is something that we actually don't know. And I think the key party on which we should be focusing is Hunt and Williams, because they were really the ringleaders of it.
Right. These are the, this is the outfit that when you want someone to do your dirty work, this is the way that you keep plausible deniability and arm's length.
Precisely. I mean, you know, everyone knows that large corporations, when they want to do nefarious things, don't contract with the parties that are going to do it directly. They put all kinds of intermediaries in between, whether it be law firms or private investigators or internet security firms. That's how this always works. I mean, that's how political dirty tricks are done, and that's how corporate dirty tricks are done as well. So the idea that Bank of America never directly retained H.B. Gary is something that I don't find surprising, but I also don't find significant. You know, the question is, what was the ultimate resolution, the ultimate disposition of the discussions between Hunt and Williams on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce and Bank of America and these firms, however it was that they were identifying themselves, whichever of them was the coordinating party?
And
that we don't know.
Has there been any emails that have surfaced or that you're aware of that indicate that this was a new relationship for Hunt and Williams in terms of dealing with these three security firms?
No, and in fact, there's, to the contrary, emails that indicate that they worked together in the past, that that's how they basically became came to be in contact. So, you know, I don't know whether specifically H.B. Gary has worked with Hunt and Williams in the past, but certainly there are emails suggesting some standing relationship between some of these parties and the individual executives at them and Hunt and Williams. That's how they came to be in contact.
Now, the on the chamber side, the H.B. Gary proposal targeted institutions, entities like SEIU, StopTheChamber.org, the VelvetUnderground.net, and I believe also Brad Friedman,
right?
The blogger Brad Friedman was also targeted in this one. And then on the other side, on the WikiLeaks side, you were one of the members of the media. In fact, as far as I can tell, the only one. I'm actually looking at the PDF right now of the PowerPoint, and I want to shift this a little bit to a broader issue that was exposed in this PDF, because it there's almost a certain amount of poetry here. Because I was on last night, the virtually speaking, and the last time to talk about this a little bit, the last time I was there, I used you as an example of the problems of our mainstream media, and I used you as a counterexample. Something to the effect of Glenn Greenwald is a perfect example of someone who is fearless and will report on anything, will call anything out, because he does not have the same incentive, or seemingly seem to have the same incentive structure as establishment careerist journalists. And sure enough, in what is like a bit of poetry, I'm going to read from the bullet point on this. And it has the, I guess, the Palantir logo on top of it. Glenn, as it has a mapping, a sort of a social networking mapping of supporters of WikiLeaks, Glenn was critical in the Amazon to OVH transition. What does that refer to?
It refers to the time period where WikiLeaks was removed from the internet, when Amazon terminated its contract to host WikiLeaks' site. And that was when really the focus on the persecution of WikiLeaks began. And then they had to find a different hosting service to be able to stay on the internet. So I guess it's saying that in that period, I played an important role in sustaining public support for WikiLeaks.
Yes. And then it goes on to say it's this level of support that needs to be disrupted. And then the next bullet point, which is literally is almost poetic in its irony, there are established professionals that have a liberal bent, But ultimately, most of them, if pushed, will choose professional preservation over cause. Such is the mentality of most business professionals.
Right.
Let's talk about this in sort of a more abstract way, because I think this is actually accurate. I think it's my sense, having read you since probably your second or third post on Unclaimed Territory back, I don't know if it was 2004 or 2005, is that this is exactly what does not describe
it. Right.
But let's talk about this, because this is an important insight that they are sharing with us.
Right. That is the interesting part. I mean, as far as it, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I've essentially devoted almost all of my conscious efforts in terms of how I would be a political writer to avoiding exactly that dynamic. So where I would have in some situation have a forced choice presented between preservation of career and cause. I mean, the whole reason why it's so imperative for me to remain independent and not work within a corporate structure and not have any editorial oversight or anything like that, which I don't, and to be accountable only to my readers is precisely because I never wanted to be in a position where I would have to choose between preservation of career and cause. And it's the same reason why I'm, you know, insistent about doing what I do without relying upon access to political insiders, or being able to, you know, being forced to use anonymous sources who feed me information that I then have to please or whose agenda I have to remain loyal. It's exactly for that reason that I have set up my ability to write about politics in a way that the only thing that I have to care about is keeping credibility with my readers. And ironically, the only way that I would actually damage my career, given the way I've set it up, is if I did choose preservation of career over cause. That's the only thing that could really damage the credibility that I built up with my readers. And that's the only thing that matters. But I think that they do have an important insight into how journalism works generally, and the fact that they believe that by in some way threatening a journalist's career, they can deter them from engaging in advocacy or journalism, and that most people in this profession will prioritize careerist objectives over conviction and belief. The fact that they think that, I think, is a reflection of what is true in the profession, which is that most establishment journalists, by definition, work for large corporations. Their journalism depends upon maintaining favor with the very people whom they're covering for access and leaks and scoops and the like. And they've positioned themselves so that they're dependent on the very system over which they're supposed to be exercising adversarial scrutiny. And so I think in that regard, this proposal provides some truth, some correct observations about the incentive scheme generally. But it's precisely because of my contempt for that incentive scheme that I don't think they'd be very successful in trying to apply it to me. But the abstract notion, I think, is accurate.
And it almost strains credibility to believe that this was simply a theory that had never gone tested with them. I mean, this has been developed. This is these are security firms that obviously work with one of the most powerful law firms in the country, one, in fact, which was recommended by the Department of Justice. And so when they say that these are established professionals that have a liberal bent, but ultimately most of them, if pushed, will choose professional preservation over cause, they probably, and we have no evidence of this, but they probably have experience which has developed this mentality.
Well, that stands to reason, right? I mean, this is what to me is such a striking point, which is there are aspects of their proposal that are, you know, definitely, you know, would be controversial if exposed, but even more so are almost certainly illegal. I mean, they're talking about fabricating forged documents and submitting them to WikiLeaks with the intent that they be published and then attacking WikiLeaks for having done it. I mean, that is almost certainly forgery and fraud, which are felonies under the U.S. Code, under criminal law. The idea of threatening the careers of journalists to deter them from writing about things or advocating what they believe in is certainly some form of extortion, depending on what it entails. I mean, they were talking about, you know, the synagogue to which one of the targets went in the Chamber of Commerce proposal, about the family members of other people that could constitute blackmail and other forms of harassment. They're talking about compromising, you know, the website of WikiLeaks by cyber attacking it and hacking it to find out who their confidential sources are in order to erode trust between WikiLeaks and their sources, which is a violation of all kinds of serious cyber laws. And yet here you have these highly experienced firms who are not only willing to propose these things to Hunt and Williams and the Chamber of Commerce and Bank of America, but who are also feeling free to put them down on paper. You know, extremely pernicious and probably illegal proposals. Why are they willing that so brazenly to, you know, to do that? And I think the obvious answer is because this is commonplace in that world. I mean, these were firms vying for very lucrative contracts. And these are firms that have lucrative contracts with exactly these kind of parties. So they have an understanding of what is and is not permissible and tolerated and encouraged in that world. And so they're not just randomly and for the first time creating a proposal to threaten the careers of people and target them personally and their families personally and to pressure journalists out of saying and doing things that they don't want to be done. This is obviously par for the course. This is how this world operates. And that's why they had no compunction about not just proposing it, but doing it in writing. That to me is the most striking and revealing part.
Yeah, it's incredibly stunning. And now let me ask you this. Assuming that they never, ever, ever carried out any type of proposals like this in the past or, you know, up to this point, that they simply coincidentally have been teamed up with these two other firms in the past, have been were basically told by Hunt and Williams to pitch us proposals. They were brazen enough to put them into PowerPoints. And present them in the same way you would as if you were doing some type of event planning. If they had never engaged in this behavior but only essentially agreed to come around to work out these proposals, is there any type of charges just involved in that type of conspiracy at all?
That's a difficult question to answer. I mean, if all they're doing is proposing it, but no steps were ever taken of any kind to execute it, it's possible that they would have fallen short of the criminal law. I mean, in general, for instance, you can plot to commit a crime. Let's say you and I sit around one day and decide that we want to rob a bank, and we even talk generally about how to do it. It doesn't really become a conspiracy. I mean, we could commit the crime without actually robbing the bank, just the conspiracy to rob the bank. But in order to do that, to even be guilty of conspiracy, you actually have to take at least one affirmative step towards executing the plan. And if all they did here was propose this and it never went anywhere, it's possible that it fell short. At the same time, they didn't just talk about it. They actually created a slideshow, a plan, very specific plan about how to go about doing it. And so it's possible that could rise to the level of criminal liability. I mean, that would be a difficult question.
And if there's any evidence that shows in these in this latest group of emails or in the emails that have yet to be sifted from that, in fact, they went ahead and created one of these false personas they were talking about, if they went ahead and got any of the information that they needed to carry out any of these proposals, that may be in some ways criminal, make them criminally liable.
Right, but see, this is, you know, in theory, yes. But what is so interesting about this is there was a 2008 report, a secret report prepared by the Pentagon about how to destroy WikiLeaks. And it talked about how WikiLeaks was an enemy of the United States and needed to be crippled. And this was even before the Apache helicopter video was released, before anyone really knew what WikiLeaks was. The Pentagon had identified them as an enemy. And the steps that the Pentagon discussed for how to cripple WikiLeaks' credibility was quite similar to what these groups are talking about, which is, you know, creating false documents and submitting it to WikiLeaks to then make them publish it, and that would destroy their credibility, or compromising the confidentiality of their sources to destroy the trust between people who want to submit to WikiLeaks and WikiLeaks itself. So that's what I mean. These are the mores that prevail in the world of government and corporations. And so it is almost impossible to imagine the Justice Department, the same Justice Department that is obsessed with destroying WikiLeaks, prosecuting a bank like Bank of America or any of these entities, Hunt and Williams, who they actually helped try to put this plan together, at least by recommending to Bank of America that they hire Hunt and Williams. It's impossible to imagine anybody, the DOJ, prosecuting anybody for targeting WikiLeaks' enemies or supporters, rather, or for targeting opponents of the Chamber of Commerce. The law in the United States just simply doesn't work that way. And, you know, the example that I cited, which I don't know, for me is just so unbelievable, even though it's so long ago now, relatively speaking, is that when, you know, as I started out by saying, the cyber attacks that were unleashed by Anonymous on PayPal and Amazon and MasterCard and the like were pretty minor in the scheme of things. I mean, they were basically just routine denial of service attacks that didn't even take down the websites. They just slowed them down. I think they might have taken one of them down for like an hour, but they were pretty trivial in the scheme of things in terms of the damage. By contrast, there were cyber attacks launched at WikiLeaks that were very sophisticated and complex and dangerous that actually took WikiLeaks offline a couple of months ago. And yet the Justice Department was very aggressive about announcing that it was going to investigate the attacks from Anonymous at PayPal and Amazon and Visa. And they actually arrested a few of them just a couple weeks ago, but they never uttered a peep about how they're going to find the culprits who did the sophisticated cyber attack launched at WikiLeaks. And that's because the Justice Department is happy with attacks on WikiLeaks and their supporters. They only care about attacks that target large corporations and that are done on behalf of WikiLeaks. It's an extremely selective application of law by the government. And so even if in theory some of this rose to the level of criminal liability, it's impossible for me to see the Justice Department punishing somebody for targeting WikiLeaks and its supporters. I think the Justice Department would consider that to be a good thing, even if it violated the law.
Right. Now, finally, do you think that there is any opportunity for any type of state attorney generals to get involved in this, or is there any type of civil liability that someone like yourself or Brad Friedman or any of these organizations that were potentially targeted, there is some type of civil liability in this case?
That's a good question about the state attorneys general. I hadn't thought about that. I mean, in general, these are probably federal crimes. At the same time, some of the individuals involved live in particular states, and the state attorney general could very well have an interest in protecting their citizens from these kind of smear campaigns. So that is possible. As far as civil liability is concerned, in general, it's easier to sue somebody than it is to prosecute them for lots of different reasons. It's very possible that targets of these campaigns, even if these campaigns didn't end up being fully executed, could nonetheless have a cause of action. Being able to sue would have the main benefit of enabling discovery to find out who did what, get these documents, put people under oath, ask questions, and compel them under penalty of perjury to answer. And so I know that there's at least some people who were named in these proposals who are actively considering that.
Right. I would imagine right now EFF and the ACLU should be answering their phones, or somebody should be funding some type of lawsuit to find out exactly what everybody in these outfits knew about it and when.
I expect that to happen.
Glenn Greenwald from Salon.com, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Sam. Always a pleasure. Bye-bye.
And now, folks, we are going to take a break. We've given you an extra bonus couple of, 20 minutes today on the pre-show. Or the show, and now we're going to the flip side, the post-show. Remember, you will receive both the show and the post-show if you become a member at Majority.fm. And stick around later today, actually in just about a half an hour, we're going to do a shorter post-show. I will be on with Mike Papantonio, who is subbing for Ed Schultz on The Ed Show. I think I'm going to be doing about 2 hours of radio with Pap today. So check it out. We'll be talking about these stories and more. I will take your IMs on the other side. IM me now at Majority FM. Majority FM, you can check it out right after this. And see you on the flip side. All right, we are back. We are back on the Majority Report. This is the post show. You can IM me at Majority FM. It is Valentine's Day, ladies and gentlemen, and you know what that means. I'm doing double duty today because it is also my wife's birthday. So this day is fraught with traps, with emotional traps for me. And I shouldn't say what I got her for her birthday because she could be listening. But, I'll talk about it tomorrow. I'm not going to. She could be listening. It happens on rare occasions. Actually, my mother-in-law, I think, is in town now, so they're probably not sitting around listening to the show together.
They could be.
They could be. So I'm going to lay off telling you what I got her. And, of course, if she is listening, I have spanned the globe to find these presents. It was very difficult. Multiple presents. We will have the Glenn Greenwald audio up as embeddable links, as embeddable audio soon. Mm-hmm. As you know, a lot of the show, the interviews, I don't know what percentage of the show we usually put up as embeddable links, and you can always get those at majority.fm. Just look for the audio clips menu page up at the top, and we send those out, and people post them on various blogs. So check that out. And now let's go to the IM. I've got only about another 10, 15 minutes because I'll be doing I'll be joining Mike Papantonio on the Ed Show. Check your local listings. I think it's going to be the first time I've been on WRL in a long time in New York City. I'm very excited about that. Let's go to David. Valentine's Day is not technically made up. Romans celebrated pagan celebration in mid-February, commemorating young men's rite of passage to the god Lupercus. Just another Roman holiday stolen by the Christians. Yeah, I guess so. The idea of sending cards, I think it came out of Hallmark. Yeah. And I think that actually the first Valentine's card was started in Worcester, Massachusetts. So good.
Sign of things to come.
Yes. And then shortly thereafter, and then also, not coincidentally, also the home where the birth control pill was developed. All those Valentines, we had to slow that down. This chamber leak story, it has just broken that there is now evidence in these emails. Think Progress has just posted this story. There is now evidence in these emails that the chamber did have direct contact with these security firms. So remember, the flowchart goes, Chamber of Commerce hires Hunton and Williams, a lobbying/legal firm. And Hunt Williams solicited the security firms Palantir, H.B. Gary, and Barrico Technologies. And at the time this morning when I had the conversation with Glenn Greenwald, we were not aware that there was any evidence that there was direct contact between the chamber and the security firms. It is now clear that there was, according to these emails. So this is going to be huge, I think. I mean, or alternatively, the mainstream media will completely ignore it. I mean, there is a story this weekend in the New York Times, and it was from, and Charlie Savage is one of the writers. This guy is ferocious. Savage is a great reporter. You'll remember back in the day, he did a lot of the stuff on signing statements in the Bush administration and their abuse of presidential power. Sadly for all of us, that beat didn't really change too much when Obama came into power. Such is the way of those in power. They do not give up power willingly. And certainly this is a good couple of weeks to see that play out in more extreme relief. You know, in this country, the powerful still employs co-optation methods to hide that dynamic. Jay Shivo, Frumkin, no one could have predicted that community organizer Obama would cut block grants. Sort of like he wouldn't escalate the wars. Obama's not done defiling himself. Expect him to oblige the right wing by doing something dramatic to undermine the African-American community before the election. Well, I'm not sure how much more dramatic he can get when he's cutting all sorts of programs for the middle class and for poor people. You know, I don't know if he will come out with something that specifically hurts African Americans any more so than just average, you know, just the just Americans in general. But who knows? I remember Marin's joke that finally African Americans will have the opportunity to get screwed over by one of their own. And Matthew wishes happy birthday. Mark Green says, jazzed about the interview with Marin tomorrow. I love that guy. We'll also have William Grider on the program tomorrow. It is a wealth of riches. And Grider, of course, will come on and he'll tell us about what's going on in the comedy world. My Sammy Cam is not in effect. Have I been sequestered? Audio stream cut off, too. Ooh. There is no Sammy Cam today because of technical difficulties. However, not coincidentally, we have a new member of the Majority FM family. I would like to welcome the Crook. The Crook is a fully functioning Mac Mini. Brought to us by listener Crook. I'm eating a piece of chocolate that I got at Guy and Gillard for free. Giving out little heart chocolates. And we just got to get the right cable for the Sammy Cam. You know, maybe we'll even switch cameras. I have some USB, some like live action. We may have to download the hardware or something like that.
Sammy Cam was a nice match to the old computer because it was also old and half broken.
That's right. Yes. Sometimes when you, it's like, it's as if you were just to lift weights with one arm. And then all of a sudden the rest of your body has a problem because it's making, there's one arm that's extremely powerful. Everything else is anemic. Pluger, so what did you stream over the weekend? How did you like it then? I don't know what that means. So what did you stream over the weekend, and how did you like it then? What did I watch on Netflix or on demand? Okay. Sadly, nothing. Sadly, nothing. Didn't watch anything this weekend. You know, we are sequestering, so I had to update all the members coming in and whatnot. And so I just didn't. It was a work weekend. The iTunes is hinky, says Tripp. Kevin, it seems that hiring H.B. Gary would be a legal act that could be prosecuted. It went beyond the planning stage to disgusting tactics. P.S. Another great show. So how can we keep the story alive? Well, I'm going on today onto the Ed Show. Mike Papantonio is subbing. As you know, I am recently joined Ring of Fire Radio, and Pap is bringing me on, and I intend to be talking about this story. And the way to do it is when we get that embeddable link from Glenn Greenwald, send it everywhere. Post it on your Facebook pages. Link to it on your Twitter. If you have a blog, put it on your blog. Send it to people who have blogs. Post it in comment sections. We got to get people talking about this story. This is as Glenn said, it stretches the bounds of imagination to assume this is just a one-off. you know, this is the way business works. You work with the people you always work with. And these guys aren't putting this into a PowerPoint if they don't feel comfortable with what they're doing. We're really going far afield this time. Let's put it into a PowerPoint. Dradmanthes, hi Sam, thanks for following the Chamber of Commerce story. Keep it up. Also, let's join with the Romans and win back this unholy Christian capitalist holiday for the pagans. But let's still call it Valentine's Day to avoid unnecessary confusion. You got it. Bush in chains. The CIA is Ken Lay and Hosni. Mubarak rumored to have fallen into a coma.
Hey, what happened?
Well, I guess it's going to make it sort of difficult for him to talk about that $70 billion he had stowed away. Yes, this is a story I didn't get to today, but Governor Scott Walker says Wisconsin National Guard is prepared to respond. The governor of Wisconsin has announced that he's going to, from this point forward, basically unilaterally dissolve state workers' unions, not allow them to negotiate using using any of the power of a union. There's no collective bargaining. And he's already stated, I have spoken to the National Guard, and if there's any type of protest, I'm sending them out. I don't know, you know. I guess Tunisia, Egypt, America. That's the way these things work, I guess, huh? Fractally, I've been struggling to figure out how much per year I could afford to pay you to listen to your show. Free just doesn't seem to fare to you. Would you accept 20 a year from now? Look, Fractally, send me an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. I think probably by Wednesday we're going to have a one-off donate button. And if you cannot afford an all-access membership to both the post and pre-show, send me an email. We will work it out. There will be no one who is denied access to the show because they are undergoing economic hardship. And then, you know, with a donate button, you can give as you are comfortable giving. I appreciate the sentiment, and but I have faith in you that things will turn around. And if they don't, well, then the show becomes that much more important. And so I don't want to ever feel like someone is putting their ability to pay for their medicine or their food or education for their children or daycare or healthcare, whatever it is. I don't want for a moment to worry that someone is putting any of that in jeopardy. I don't want this show to be a source of, you know, paying for the show or supporting the show to be a source of stress in people's lives. I want it to just be a source of stress in my life, in Evan's life, in Dorsey's life, and Jessica's life. That I want there to be intense stress. Nefertiti. Happy Valentine's Day and to you and to the team. And back at you, Nefer, and happy birthday, Nikki. Thank you. I will send along your... Here's something Obama doing for black people. Obama budget increases federal prison budget by 10%. Well, touche. The Ed Show. Do you mean his radio show or the TV show? The radio show. It's ongoing right now. I'm going to be jumping on in about 10 minutes onto that program. SPAF, this is where the teacher and the classified workers should walk out with the state workers. The National Guard would not be able to fill in for the schools. Look, I think that, yes, we've got to see unions across the board, private and public, support the union workers in Wisconsin. This is put up or shut up time. And, you know, for too long, the union leadership has made certain trade-offs, political trade-offs, and certain short-term decisions that I think have you know, it's all come to home to roost. And so there's got to be, we've got to begin in this country, particularly on the left, to make our voices heard and to inflict pain on the system. And it may be painful for us as well. Tim Johnson, Bangkok Line. On Sunday, the red shirts in Thailand protested for the first time since the crackdown, probably inspired by Egypt. They demanded the release of their leaders in front of the Ministry of Justice. The yellow shirts counter-demonstrated, urging a harder line against Cambodia. The demonstrations were peaceful. News from the Cambodian border is that the fighting between Cambodia and Thailand has stopped. Well, that's good news. Borrello, Dr. Kathy says a donate button would be helpful for members to help defray the cost of hardship members. Yes, exactly. And I'll be putting that up. I mean, there's so many things that we have, a list of things that we want to do. And, you know, we're getting it done piece by piece. And thank goodness, let me just do this, a paltry compensation, a paltry thank you, not nearly expressing the appreciation I have for Avant, who has been just building out the majority FM website in a way that is unbelievable. And, you know, we have people sending in graphics, and David, listener David, who basically created the Majority Report graphic, and Kyle, who is working hours upon hours to set up a system that's going to a robust system so that our members are going to have the ability. It's fascinating. Let me just do this. Let me do this first. As a member, and you will receive information within the next couple of days or so, you'll be able to go to the Majority Report website, and without having to do anything once you've signed in, you will see content that other people can't see, that mere humans, mere mortals, will not be able to see. So it will be a seamless experience for you as a Majority Report member. You would just be able to see full show content and any bonus posts that we put up and whatnot, which we will begin to do as we catch our breath here. And it will be seamless. Now, I imagine over the next week or so, we're going to have problems with the system. But, you know, I also imagine we would have problems putting out this show on a daily basis. And for the most part, we've had none. Absolutely none. Knock on corrugated fake veneer wood that we use as our desks. The podcast comes out every day within an hour. You know, and to the extent that we've had any problems, it's always been like an iTunes problem. It's never been ours.
Show goes in, podcast comes out.
It really is impressive. The Majority Report team is second to none. Upbeat nihilist, have you gone back and reread Obama's Cairo University speech from a year and a half ago? Pretty interesting in context of events. I haven't, but I will. I know that that came up in the context of, I've discussed it in the context of right-wing complaints. Of, you know, what Obama had done or whatnot. Cry Popville. Everyone talks about how jobs and adequate pay is important, but Obama and local government turns quickly to freeze pay increases to the largest workforce in the country to turn the... I'm not sure of the point, but yes. What we're seeing is a budget that has nothing to do with creation of jobs. FDI's senior advisor says Bush and Chains jumps to Goldman Sachs.
Surprise!
It really is unbelievable. I mean, we really do have a plutocracy here. We have had a plutonomy, which, of course, is the sort of hyper-rich, these uber-rich. And now it's a plutocracy because they also now control our politics and our government. Will Kevin, 11721, will the members in the area website have a place for our Craigslist shirtless photos? Of course, are you kidding? Of course. Pluger, FYI, Wisconsin organized labor is leading protests over the next 3 days opposing, I posted a link at the blog, listing planned protests. Great, I will check it out at Majority FM. I will check that out right now as we speak. I would be happy to report that on the Ed Show today if they have not already mentioned it. I would imagine they have, but never hurts to do it over and over again. Let's see. Okay, I got it, Pluger. Thank you very much. It's right there. Wisconsin response to Governor Scott Walker's stand in, today, 11 a.m., stand in solidarity at the Concourse Hotel. iHeart UW rally at 11:30 a.m. in Milwaukee, 10:30 to 1 p.m. Today, Eau Claire, South Middle School in Eau Claire. ECAE and other labor groups are organizing it. Janesville, great. It's great to see unions. This is what it's all about with unions.
The link is now up on our Facebook page as well, if anybody wants to see it there.
Great. All right, folks, I've got to say goodbye 5 minutes early today. I'm going to be on the Ed Show with substitute host Mike Papantonio in just moments. Check it out if you can. Tomorrow on the program, William Grider of The Nation. And, God damn it. What's that guy's name? From that,
some podcast.
Mark Maron. Yes, Mark Maron will be joining us tomorrow. All right, folks. Have a great Valentine's Day. If I don't make it in tomorrow, it's because I didn't give Nikki good presents and she beat me so badly that I couldn't even make it in.
You don't get paid for the rope that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the man's not gonna kick in. Shifting.